Okay. The Judiciary Finance Division is now in session. And we are going to deal with the Civil Legal Services budget overview. Thank you for your patience. And we have 1 hour scheduled for the rest of the committee. I'm hopeful that we can address both Civil Legal Services and the Uniform Law Commission in that time. If you feel for some reason there's something that is left undealt with, we'll certainly be willing to find time to do that. But please, Ms. Hockadal, why don't you proceed? Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Kathy Hockadal. I am the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, and with me is Jean Lestine. She's the Executive Director of Central Minnesota Legal Services, and Jean is going to start.
Thank you, Senator Latz and members of the committee.
I'm sorry. I am going to interrupt you for a second because I did tell Senator Sharon we'd give her 2 minutes. So if we could wait just one more minute and give her an opportunity to return, I don't want to have misled her. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, no problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris is so happy he doesn't need that. Better know. The tape that's we need tape to start out. All right, two minutes having passed. We're going to return to the agenda here. Ms. Lestine, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We thought we'd start today with just a client story that will illustrate our work and the work of legal aid lawyers across the state of Minnesota. And I want to tell you a little bit about a client named Mary. I'll call her Mary, who contacted our office shortly before Thanksgiving. Mary is 57 and single. She's been a waitress much of her working life. And she contacted us because she had a problem navigating the healthcare system. Mary had been getting her healthcare through MinnesotaCare. She had been working as a waitress, paying a monthly premium for MinnesotaCare. And then in late spring of last year, she was diagnosed with colon cancer. And eventually, Mary became unable to work, and her own county worker told her she was now eligible for medical assistance. So she was on medical assistance, which requires a requalification period, and had filled out the paperwork to become requalified. And Mary became unable to work because she was going through chemotherapy, which just left her too weak to work full-time, which is why she became eligible for medical assistance. And then one day in the mail, Mary got a notice saying her medical assistance was being terminated. And she was quite surprised and shocked and actually dismayed because she had filled out the paperwork. And she also had chemotherapy treatments scheduled within the next few days. She had tried calling the county and had been put on hold, could not reach her worker. And then she called us, and this was just a few days before a scheduled chemotherapy treatment. Our lawyer got on the matter right away, and he had some other numbers to call because he had relationships with county health care workers. And he was able to call the worker and find out that the worker had made a mistake, that Mary was still, in fact, eligible for medical assistance, that she would be able to go to the hospital to have her treatments in the next few days, and they would be covered. And Mary was worried because her notice said her benefits would be terminated if she didn't appeal in 10 days. And our attorney knew that he would probably win at the appeal level, but that this should be able to be resolved. I'm happy to say that our attorney was able to call the worker, make the resolution possible over the phone and with an exchange of documents. We never had to file an appeal, even though our attorney was confident we would win the appeal for Mary. And Mary was able to go to the hospital a few days later and have her next scheduled chemotherapy treatment. And this kind of a scenario in terms of helping low-income Minnesotans navigate the healthcare system to get benefits for which they are eligible and have been receiving is fairly typical of the type of legal problem that our attorneys across the state of Minnesota in civil legal services might find themselves helping a client with. And we hope that sort of sets the stage to give you some idea of the kinds of legal issues our attorneys deal with. And we have additional information that we'd like to present to you. And for that, I'd like to turn it over to Kathy Hockadahl.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. Jean has told you a story that shows how we change the lives of Minnesotans. In fact, 48,000 of them in 2011. And I'm going to talk a little more about the nuts and bolts, an overview about of how our network works, the widening justice gap in Minnesota, our funding situation, particularly our state funding, and some ideas at the end on how we might close the justice gap in Minnesota. Her story also illustrates the impact we have on the lives of Minnesotans. We promote strong and stable families by preventing homelessness and by ensuring access to health care, as the story Jean told illustrates. We help people in Minnesota be safe. We help victims of domestic violence. In fact, a national study showed that one of the two most important factors in reducing domestic violence in a community is having the availability of a civil legal services office. We reduce financial exploitation. I'm sure you know that particularly in the recession, this has become a particular problem for vulnerable people, particularly seniors and people with disabilities. And we help promote efficiency in government. In the judicial system, we promote efficiency by providing representation for people who have meritorious cases, and we keep people out of the system if they don't have a meritorious case, because that's what we tell them. We're very candid with people. We won't take cases that don't have some legal merit. We also create efficiency in the system by providing training to the public and to professionals about legal issues, and we have substantial websites that I'll talk about in just a minute that provide legal resources for the entire state. We help people solve real problems, like the one Jean illustrated. We look only at matters of civil law. We don't do any criminal law. And we help people with legal issues that relate only to their basic human needs, the need for shelter, the need for safety, the need for sustenance, and the need for health care. We're a network of nonprofit organizations. We have 6 regional organizations that serve every county in the state of Minnesota. Those regional programs, like Jean's and mine, provide a full range of legal services on a number of different issues, which is really important because people come into our offices, they think they have one problem, but they very well have 2 or 3 legal problems. Like a woman who came to us one time for unemployment compensation, she'd been denied it. When she talked to her attorney, it turned out she was also a victim of domestic violence. Not only did we get her unemployment compensation benefits, but we were able to get a dissolution, get her child custody, and get her child support. So she now is safe, in addition to having the proper income supports. Our network also includes about 2 dozen targeted, smaller programs that either focus on a specific legal need or on a particular geographic area, such as a county. We provide several types of services. We do full representation, helping people who need to go to court or to proceed in an administrative agency proceeding. We also provide a great deal of advice and consultation, resolving many matters without the need to go to court, as in the case Jean described. And we provide significant education and self-help resources. As I said, we train professionals across the state, such as law enforcement, medical professionals, social workers, librarians, and court people on matters affecting legal matters affecting people with low incomes and disabilities. And we have significant web-based services that we've developed. Our Law Help Min website is a public resource available to anyone in Minnesota. It has over 130 legal fact sheets on it, written at a basic literacy level, so almost anybody can read them. And it is the most critical component of the various self-help services that are available in the courts and in the public libraries, so that people who cannot qualify for our services or we simply don't have the resources to help still can perhaps engage in some self-help. Our website had more than 260,000 unique visits in 2012. That's not page visits, that's unique visits. We also developed and maintained the ProJustice Min website, which is
Ms. Hockadall, if you hold on a moment, Senator Dietzick had a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. When the judges were in last week or the week before, they talked about at least at Hennepin County, we have a bunch of kiosks that have some self-help information. Is this the same, similar, and are they connected?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we're very connected. We work together. They have a self-help desk. We provide assistance, particularly Ms. Lestine's program, at that self-help center. They also use our Law Help Min website a great deal to help people. So the availability of the court self-help desks and civil legal services working hand in glove is really what makes pro se assistance available to the general public.
Thank you.
Also, members, your budget binder that you have there, the last tab on civil legal services, does contain a printout of the presentation on the screen as well. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair. In addition, our ProJustice Min website is part of what we do to leverage volunteer attorney resources around the state. There are many forms that volunteer attorneys can use on that site. And also briefs and memoranda of law and things like that that we can share. We are really the infrastructure for leveraging pro bono assistance. We've trained them, we mentor them, we provide the website for them. And volunteer attorneys in the state make it much easier, although it's not easy, to help the many people who need our assistance. We work in a number of different areas, a full range of services, as I indicated before, but we have three really major areas that take most of our time: the area of family and domestic violence, the area of economic stability and benefits, and the area of housing. We serve many, many, many Minnesotans, 48,000 in 2011. We don't have the statistics from the Supreme Court yet for 2012. Those will be available in March. Most of our clients have family incomes, household incomes of 125% or less of the federal poverty guidelines. That's about $28,000 for a family of four. We only address basic human needs, as I indicated before, and we do look at legal merit. It's important to us to hold in trust the resources that are provided to us. But there's a growing justice gap in Minnesota for people with civil legal needs. We've never met all the need, but the gap used to be like this, and due to the recession, it's really gone like this. We did studies ourselves of the people we turn away, and in 2009, we were able to help one of every two people who were eligible for our services and actually contacted us. In 2012, we only helped one out of three of those people. What has happened during the recession is that the number of people eligible for our services in Minnesota has increased by over 20%, and our financial resources have decreased by 16%. So we served almost 53,000 people in 2009, and we served 48,000 in 2011, and I'm quite certain that when the 2012 statistics are available, they will show another significant decline. In addition, we've had to shift so that we're doing less full representation so that we can extend our resources to meet the needs of more people. We have three sources of state-administered funding: the general fund appropriation, which is currently at a little over $11 million. By statute, 85% of that money goes to the regional programs I described for you, and 15% is made by discretionary grants to other programs, all of the money is administered by the Supreme Court's Legal Services Advisory Committee. The committee also administers interest on lawyers' trust account funds that this year are estimated to be $757,000, and attorney registration fee funds this year estimated to be $1.8 million. Those are, again, granted out through discretionary grants. As you can see from the graph, our funding has been going down, 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 unfortunately, from all of these sources. And frankly, it's gone down from the other sources. And we do have a number of other sources. As the pie chart indicates, we will seek money from anywhere we think we can get it. We seek money and get it from the United Ways across the state, from foundations. We have federal grants and contracts. We have county and city grants and contracts. And we do private fundraising both with the bar and with the general public. But as I indicated, it's really declining from all directions. And what that has meant is reductions in staff, which frankly directly translates into reduction in capacity to help low-income Minnesotans. We've done salary freezes, mandatory furloughs, we've absorbed attrition, and we've all had layoffs. Our staffs have shrunk by 25% between 2007 and 2011. We've also done our best to increase efficiencies, and I think that's one of the reasons, frankly, that we haven't seen a 25% reduction in the number of people served in Minnesota. We've done as many service consolidations as we can, and we share backroom administration as often as we can. We also have developed as many technological tools as we can to make ourselves more efficient internally and to reach more people through law help, through using other technological means so we can reduce travel throughout the state, et cetera. But nonetheless, we are serving fewer people. There just has not been a way around that. We would, of course, like to see the justice gap close somewhat. We think one way to approach that is to increase our general fund appropriation, and that's what we would ask of you, to have the pre-recession level capacity to serve clients would mean that we would be once again closer to 50,000 people, or actually to 52 or 3,000 people that we could, and families that we could help every year. In addition, we are going to be asking to increase our capacity by removing the restrictions that were imposed on our use of the state appropriation in 2011. It was the first time restrictions had been imposed on how the money was used since we've received legislative funding for 30 or more years. And the restrictions required that we prioritize the money for matters of purely state law. The only way we could prove we could prioritize, the Supreme Court decided, was to require that we actually timekeep so that we only use the money for matters of state law. That really decreases our flexibility in meeting the needs of Minnesotans, and it makes it more difficult to bring in certain federal funding that is helpful. For example, all the Social Security and Medicaid funding streams, we cannot use the state appropriation to bring those federal funds into Minnesota. We think by closing the justice gap, we can improve the lives of the tens of thousands of Minnesotans. And in addition, we can promote confidence in the justice system. Confidence in the rule of law is essential to our democracy. People have confidence when they think they have access to the justice system. So that we hope that we can close the justice gap slowly but surely over the next few years. And I think confidence in the justice system is a good reason to do it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Hockadahl. Are there any questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question of, do you have a formula to how much money you actually need per case or per demand? You've used the terms justice gap, and I'm wondering if that's a defined, or we have some parameters around it that can measure whether you have a growing justice gap or not. I'm not quite sure what justice gap even means, but could you put a little more parameter to that term? Because I wanted to know if it is growing, then it should be easy to equate a number to it. And I'm just wondering if you could help us understand what that means.
Ms. Hockadall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. Well, it's not a defined term. It's a term we have developed to describe the phenomenon we've seen as people are less and less available to access our services and thereby access justice. What we have measured to show it is the increase in poverty population and decrease in our services, but in addition, that unable to serve survey that I indicated, and you all have a copy of the PowerPoint as the chair indicated in your materials, where we did our own survey to measure how many people who called us we were able to serve versus turning away in 2009, and comparing that to 2012, where we are turning away many more people who are eligible for our services. I think that's an important part of that unable to serve survey. We were not measuring people we were turning away who really don't qualify, either because they don't meet our income guidelines or they come to us with a problem we can't solve, like personal injury or criminal. We were only counting people who actually would otherwise qualify for our services. So those are two of the ways in which we have measured the growth in the inability for us to serve low-income and disabled Minnesotans.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
is your dollar amount you're requesting, is it different than the governor's budget proposal?
Talk at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it is. The governor has recommended an increase for us of $500,000, and we certainly understand the many competing interests and his priorities and things he has to evaluate in making his recommendation. We made our request based on what we saw is the decline in number of Minnesotans, vulnerable Minnesotans that we were able to serve since the recession, and that was the basis of our $2.1 million request. And actually, that goes back to a part of your question that I'm sorry I didn't answer, which is, do we have any kind of formula for how we decide how much each case costs? And the fact is, we don't really have a formula because it really depends a lot on the complexity of the matter. If you have a family court case, a dissolution and complex child custody case that has to go to a trial in district court, that's very time consuming. If you have a quicker kind of negotiation like the situation Gene described, that isn't very time consuming. But what we did to come up with our $2.1 million request is we kind of did a ballpark average of $700 a case, which when you consider the wide range of our legal services might be roughly accurate as to how much we might spend per case. And we did some analysis of our numbers over the past several years to come up with that. It wasn't just pulled out of the blue. And that way we projected that we could serve 3,000 more families and individuals with an increase of $2.1 million.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
it seems like I'm always getting different numbers per case or per budget, and we use the term justice gap, and I hope you understand my difficulty in trying to get my head around this, because it doesn't seem to be a performance measure. That's, you're using a term that you're defining in your, or maybe lack of defining in your presentation, but I'm finding it hard to find the black and white on this as far as a performance measure. And I don't know if that changes from year to year, if the measurement changes. If it does, then I don't know how you can say people are having a growing justice gap or a shrinking justice gap. I don't know how to define this yet. And so maybe as we go through this session, if you could help me understand it a little bit better, I would appreciate that. It helps me understand your need. And, you know, and the other question is if you can, with $2.1 million, help 3,000 more people, then my question would always be as well, what about handling the next 3,000 people? then is that 4.2, or is there an economy of scale that's 3.5 or somewhere in between? I don't know how to understand these numbers. And is the goal just to help 3,000 extra people? Does that fulfill the need? Does it not fulfill the need? Is it just a number that, at least for me, helping 3,000 extra people, I don't know if I can agree with that or not. Maybe I want to help more, or maybe I want to define the need a little bit better and maybe handle the urgent issues if we have a tight budget.
Ms. Hockadell?
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, those are all very good points. We do engage in some outcome measures. I haven't had a chance in the limits of this presentation to present details about that. I would certainly be happy to have more conversations about it. We don't have an outcome measure that directly relates to the justice gap. That really is a term I'm trying to use. I think we decided to try to use to describe the overall impact for Minnesota. But we do outcome measures on our success we have on keeping people housed, on getting benefits for people, for helping victims of domestic violence achieve safety. There are a number of different measures that our programs use in that regard. We also work very hard to prioritize our work, and so that is one of the ways we attempt to use the money really to meet the most critical basic human needs of people in addressing not just access to justice, but frankly, in helping them stay housed, safe, having health care, and having food. But your points are well taken about the need to be able to show performance. We agree with that. We think that's important. We're actually always looking for new ways to do that. In addition, one of the ways we would use an increase, I understand what you're saying about 3,000. Well, there's more than 3,000 that need help. That's absolutely the case. We were trying to strike a balance and really look at the pre-recession level and get back at least to service at that level. But in addition, we would use any money we were granted to leverage for technology so we can help even more people. So there is an economy of scale in the money we receive. We work very hard to do that.
Ms. Hockadell, how much of that money would you use for that technology leverage?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a little difficult. It's a little difficult to estimate off the top of my head. I could get you some figures about what we put into our different web-based services at this time. All of our programs, one of the reasons it's difficult, we all do it individually, but we also do it jointly. For example, the web-based programs are supported by all of the regional programs. It is not just one. It's housed within Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, which I supervise, but it is jointly funded by all of the regional programs because we feel it's that important to reach all four corners of the state with technological resources. But we are always setting aside a portion of our energy and funding to expand our technological innovation to reach more Minnesotans.
And the $2.1 million that you were referring to, is that for the full biennium or is that per year?
Mr. Chair, that was per year.
Okay. So the total biennial increase would be 4.2.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Any other questions from the committee? All right.
Thank you very much.
The Uniform Law Commission. Welcome, Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Robert Tennyson, one of the Uniform Law Commissioners from Minnesota. And people wonder what the Uniform Law Commission is and what it does, so we have a 9-minute video that will explain it in great detail with a lot of flourish.
If we can figure out how to make it work.
Flourish?
Serving popcorn.
Thank you.
one sentence. Uniform Law Commission is...
It's a national organization.
Hundreds upon hundreds of volunteer attorneys.
Smart, capable, committed.
From different political persuasions.
From diverse backgrounds and fields and geographic areas.
Who attempt to draft well-crafted and well-conceived legislation.
At the state level, as opposed to having congressional action.
On specified subjects for which uniformity of law is considered to be beneficial.
To advance the general welfare of our country, the work of the Uniform Law Commission is absolutely critical to the success of our nation.
A little more than 100 years after the Founding Fathers drafted the United States Constitution, 12 representatives from 7 states met in Saratoga Springs, New York,
to continue their work perfecting the Union and maintaining a healthy balance between the state and federal governments.
The organization they formed that day came to be known as the Uniform Law Commission.
Frederick Stimson, the commission's first secretary, wrote, "It is probably not too much to say
that this is the most important juristic work undertaken in the United States since the adoption of the federal Constitution." Wow. That's quite a statement, but there's much truth in that.
Fundamentally, it's a four-step process. We research and study whether there's a need for a law. Number two, we do our best to bring in all the input and to draft the best law we can. Third, we bring it to the legislatures around the United States, educate them, answer their questions, and promote the enactment. And finally, we monitor, after it's been enacted, how is it working, and if it needs to be revised, then we start the process again.
Years and years ago, before I was elected to the House of Representatives in Washington, I worked in the Illinois State Senate for 14 years. Time and again, the Uniform Law Commission would produce laws that were considered by the General Assembly, both the House and the Senate. Time and again, they passed, because we had confidence then, as we do now, that the work product we were given was the best.
Well, the Uniform Law Commission and its Uniform Acts affects Americans in every possible way.
In our country, we don't take organs or tissues from deceased people. It's always something that the person has willed. And that whole structure, the whole idea that this is a gift, came out of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. It could have very well gone the other way. It could have very well been that we would have a market in a human kidney as if it were a medical device. The reason it didn't go that way was the Uniform Law Commissioners.
Before there was an Unclaimed Property Act, there were assets that that went unclaimed.
Mostly money type of property. The upshot was that there was a windfall to businesses because there was no one to whom they had to turn over or account for the property.
Basically, under the Unclaimed Property Act, the holders of the property have to turn it over to the state.
That basically stays with the state until somebody would come forward to claim it. The state has the use of that.
But in the time since the first version of the Unclaimed Property Act was enacted in our home state, which was sometime in the mid to late 60s, the transfer to the general fund has been in excess of $140 million. So if legislators have ever asked me whether I thought our state commission carries its own weight in terms of bringing in revenue to the state, I have a ready answer. It's a pretty good return.
Well, the crown jewel of the Uniform Law Commission is the Uniform Commercial Code. It has been adopted in every jurisdiction, and it controls commercial activity in the United States. It was jointly developed with the American Law Institute.
before the enactment of the code, I think it was more costly. There was less predictability, and business does not thrive on unpredictability. And the code greatly helped in that area.
Many businesses cross state lines and cross state borders. And think how impossible it would be without uniform laws governing transportation and trade and commerce among the states. It's just inconceivable to us. We can't even imagine a nation without having those uniform laws. We expect it.
The whole banking industry is based upon the code. Checks, the transfers of billions of dollars every hour being transferred, these are all controlled by the legislation that's come out of this conference.
The Uniform Commercial Code sets the parameters of business interaction in terms of sales, contracts, effectiveness of language in commercial transactions. It is the backbone of American commerce.
Another statute which has become very important is the Collaborative Law Act. That act has been particularly critical in providing our clients another alternative beside litigation or mediation or arbitration. It's a wonderful dispute resolution solution for them. Beautiful thing about the uniform statutes is it's not one interest group that has created the product. And they take 2-3 years to develop such a product. It's a wonderful collaborative effort of many interests, and that's why those statutes are so very important and useful.
Over time, it's been a dirty little secret of elections that it's just hard to get materials to people serving overseas and get them back in time for an election. So we were looking for a partner who could help us work in the states in particular to try to develop a solution which would be a standard solution. Because one of the other problems we identified is that with 50 states in the District of Columbia, there are 50 different sets of rules, 51 different sets of rules that these military voters all need to try to follow. We would work with them again in a minute. They share our pragmatic, non-ideological, good government approach to solving problems. And like Pew, the Uniform Law Commission would rather get it right than get it done fast. And as it turns out, they also move pretty diligently forward.
The Uniform Law Commission is a great partner for AARP. Because of the Uniform Law Commission, older Americans have better laws on the books.
We really try to strike a balance. Should there be complete uniformity? No. If there would be complete uniformity, we can just eliminate the state boundaries and just call it one single unitary nation. But we started with the premise that this is not temporary, but these boundaries are permanent. We are a collection of states.
And what is remarkable is that after all these years as a nation with separate states, we have functioned fairly well. And I attribute a great deal of that success to the work of the Uniform Law Commission.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I didn't have popcorn. I think that explains a bit of what the Uniform Law Conference does and how we, it doesn't say all how we do it. But I want to emphasize two things. One, you have in your packet a document called The Role of the Uniform Law Commission in the Federal System. And you saw a bit of that discussed here, but it's very critical for the states to have effective laws to balance the federalism. As you all know, there are many areas of law in which the federal government could preempt an area because it's part of the, under the Commerce Clause, whatever, the Uniform Commercial Code is an example. To the extent that the states act effectively and to pass laws that solve problems across interstate boundaries, you can preserve the balance in the federal system. If we don't do that, there's a push to have it always solved at the federal level. And that just doesn't come from federal legislators. That comes from business interests around the country. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, the insurance industry wanted to have a national charter. Well, the insurance industry, as you know, is governed by the states. And that's another example where they don't want to, where business ought to be more efficient for them to do it on a national level. But anyway, we play a critical role in the federal system in developing laws. And the way we do that is once we've looked at a topic, and I'll give you an example. I'm chair of a study committee right now to look at the accuracy and access to criminal records. We're ascertaining whether or not that's a project we can undertake successfully. Before we ever appoint a drafting committee, and we go through some procedures to do that. And then if we make a recommendation to go forward, it goes through a screening committee called a scope and program committee. Then it goes to the executive committee, and ultimately it's decided whether or not it will be done. I've served in all those committees and have done that for a number of years. Fortunately, I've completed my service on that. Then if a committee is appointed, the president appoints, you know, eight or so commissioners. We also have a formal arrangement with the American Bar Association, so they appoint one or two people from the sections that are involved in the topic. Also, we search out and seek anybody who has an interest in the topic, because that's how we obtain our information. We look for advisors. We look for people who want to follow. We look for them for information, and that works out. Give an example. When we redid the Securities Act, we'd have 45 people in the room. These represented all the interests that you could think of, from the federal government, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, the SEC, the business community, the various groups. But they were all there participating, and that's how we were able to figure out how to arrive at a draft that was acceptable and could be possibly passed. That's one of the key things. We don't want to engage in activities that are meaningless. We don't want to have a bill that just sits on the shelf and never gets passed, although that has happened. But anyway, so the committees then meet for a couple of years, typically. We meet on a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday morning in a hotel room and argue about this stuff, and people wonder what we do for a life. But we enjoy it, and everybody serves voluntarily. And after the committee has met for a couple of years, probably six meetings or so, we then have the bill brought to the annual meeting. And there's 300 so lawyers there. And it's read line by line and debated. The committee sits on a dais and answers questions. And they usually get a lot of good questions about why it's written this way or not that way. This is unclear. It doesn't follow. They nitpick it and solve a lot of problems. The committee then goes back and works for another year to try and solve and address those issues. And when it feels it's got another bill, a draft ready to be read, it's brought back and read line by line the next time. And I mean line by line. We don't just read a title. And then once it's approved, then the states vote on it, and a majority of the states then can promulgate it. And then it's our job as commissioners to bring it back to our states and try to seek it adopted. For your information, we're created under the statute. Our duties are to represent the state at the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, to examine legal subjects on which the uniformity of legislation is in the different states is desirable, ascertain the best means to effect uniformity, represent Minnesota in conventions of similar commissions of other states, cooperate in the consideration and drafting of Uniform Act for submission to the legislature of the several states, and then prepare bills adapting the Uniform Acts to our statutes for introduction. And that's what we do. In the conference, most immediate past president is Bob Stein, who you saw here. Bob was the dean of the law school at the university, and he was also, I think, the provost there. Incoming president this summer is Harriet Lansing, who is a commissioner from Minnesota and is recently retired from the appellate court, although I think she still sits. I served on the executive committee and the scope and program committee for, I think, a total of 8 years. And I also chaired the legislative committee for 6 years. That committee is charged with getting legislation adopted across the country. We have a small staff of lawyers in Chicago that I work with and with commissioners across the country who make up the committee. We work hard. We serve without pay, without any kind of compensation. We're required to go to the annual meeting unless we're formally excused. We'd be kicked out of the commission if we don't. But those are important events, and that's where we go, and that's the one thing the state pays directly for us, is that we get reimbursed for our travel to the annual meeting, the hotel bill, food, up to whatever the per diem rate is, and the registration fee. And that's it. When we go to the drafting committee meetings, the expenses are reimbursed by the conference for the committee. And we serve, again, without pay. We put in hundreds of hours every year working on the conference. And every Minnesota commissioner has various responsibilities. I mentioned the committee that I'm chairing the drafting or a study committee on. I'm also serving on the committee on prevention and remedies for human trafficking, which we will bring to a final vote this summer. Is an important issue. The incoming president, as I mentioned, is Harriet Lansing. In Minnesota has been very prominent in the management of the conference. For a while, people jokingly referred to us as Minnesota Mafia because there were three of us serving on the executive committee at the same time, which is a little bit unusual. We have in Minnesota passed, and you have a list of them there, about 130 uniform acts in Minnesota. The conference has, developed over the years hundreds of acts, I think about 250. We work diligently to get them passed here when we can, and I think that's been helpful to the states. What we do, with all the legal help we get, or we provide, and what we get from other commissioners from around the country, is very valuable in coming up with a final product that can be adopted here. And we feel with some confidence that it's right. We don't always get everything right, but we can fix it, as Howard Schweibel said, if we monitor it and come back. So we provide a valuable service for almost no cost to the state. Our appropriation the way the conference is funded is each state's assessed some amount basically a population. Our assessment is $54,000 a year. In addition, we estimate the annual meeting cost this year would be about $30,000, meetings in Boston. So a total of, we're asking for $84,000 per year. In addition, we've been a bit embarrassed in recent years because Minnesota has not paid its full assessment. And when you're the president of the conference, your own state hasn't paid it. It's a bit much. Last year, we were $27,000 short. The year before, $22,000. I'm rounding these off. And in previous years, over almost $14,000. So we have at least $62,000, $63,000 in monies we've not paid that we should have. So I hate to be a piker. But anyway, that's what we do, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Tennyson, could you introduce the other members of the Uniform Law Commission that are here with you today?
Yes. Barry Walsh, Harriet Lansing, Michelle Timmons. Gene Henning was here earlier, but he had to go back and work. He's with my old law firm.
Thank you, all of you, for your service.
But anyway, we enjoy doing it. We wouldn't do it if we didn't. And I find that as a lawyer, when I don't have to, I'm not advocating for a client. It's kind of like being in the legislature here. You look for the best policy and see what works. So having worked here and sitting where you are sitting for 10 or 12 years, I understand what you're going through. But anyway, our costs per year are really not much, about the cost of a staff member in the revisor's office of the legislature.
to ask Ms. Timmons that. About Mr. that. Tennyson, the governor's recommendation, as I understand it, is $98,000.
Right. I've talked to the commissioner about that, and he's asked me to submit a letter to him explaining a little bit more, which I will do.
Okay, because you'd mentioned that your annual budget is $84,000. Did I miss something there?
No,
$54,000.
$54,000. The assessment is $54,000 per
assessment.
Year. Here, I have a sheet here if you want to.
Okay, do we have more detailed information yet as part of our committee packet?
It's $54,000 is the assessment each year, and then $30,000 we're estimating expenses. And if it doesn't reach that, we don't use those expenses; they stay there.
So that's the annual. It's 84.
So it's $84,000 per year for 2 years times two. For 2 years.
Okay.
So it'd be $168,000 for the biennium.
Yeah, but that doesn't match up with the governor's.
No, he's only at 98. He's a little light.
49 and 49.
He's 49 and 49.
Yeah.
The governor had 49,000.
Current biennium. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, the appropriation has been $49,000 a year for the last 6 years, I believe.
So we've shorted the Uniform Law Commission on your annual expenses as well as on the dues.
Yeah, the way we've done that is, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, they paid our expenses and sent what was left to the conference. That's why the numbers are what they are.
Okay.
And we, when the budget was short and there were cuts across the board, we took our cuts as well as everybody else. And that's what happened. So we had less than the assessment. And then the commissioners were paid reimbursed for their expenses at the annual meeting first, and then what was left was sent to the conference.
Sounds like you may have taken more than your fair share of them.
More than our fair share?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure I understand that.
Well, we're going to do our best at least to try to catch the commission up on those past due assessments. We wouldn't want to embarrass Judge Lansing.
Well, the commissioners also, we obviously all of our expenses at the annual meeting are not covered. When food is, when you get the limit on food for per diem here, that may take care of breakfast and lunch.
Are there any questions for Mr. Tennyson, members of the committee?
Let me just ask what year by year request would be in the budget. Is it 84 and 84?
Okay. So, Mr. Tennyson, what would be your request and what would the law commission like to see per year to meet your budgetary needs? Not including catching up on past due assessments, but your
$84,000 per year.
Okay. Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. That concludes our agenda for today. We're adjourned.